Chaos. Woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning, chilling with coffee mugs, me and coffee chugs, talking education all across the nation, pushing boundaries, thinking innovation. Chaos.
Hello everyone, how you doing? Welcome to another episode on Living on the Edge of Chaos podcast. Now, I am thrilled for this conversation. One, because we had the guest I have on the show today had just a mind-boggling conversation when I finally had a chance to connect with him and one of his colleagues on some of the work that they're doing. And since then, I keep coming back to many of the ideas and notes that I jotted down. And so I'm really excited to bring this guest on the show today to not necessarily rehash that same conversation, but some of those talking points, because they made my head spin in good ways, but also to expand upon whatever has been going on since the last time I've had to connect with this guest. So I'm here today with Mario, and Mario, you will probably do a much better job explaining what it is you do. I am learning, and I'm learning a lot, and I love it, but I will probably not do it justice. So I will let you properly introduce who you are, what you do, and what in the world you got going on.
Sounds good, Aaron. Thank you for having me. Excited to continue the conversation. So my name is Mario Vasilescu. I'm the CEO and co-founder of a company called Redocracy. And Redocracy, you can think of in its simplest terms like a Fitbit for knowledge. We're making it possible to track and effortlessly quantify in a safe way all the content you consume, all the self-directed learning you do through the articles you read and the podcasts and the YouTube videos and all that stuff that you have no evidence of. We make it count and deeply count in a way that helps your mind and gives you insights like to understand yourself like never before and other cool tools. And then if you want to showcase it so you can present to the world how committed and competent you are on things without needing to go and necessarily get a full degree or do it through the traditional ways. So that's what we do. And on a bigger picture, it is a mission-driven business. What we're really trying to do is actually create a new infrastructure layer for society, which we can get to maybe later in this episode. But we really, in a nutshell, want to create a future where how you inform yourself matters more, because today it doesn't matter nearly enough, and we're seeing the consequences of that all around us. And that's not just a formal education thing, you know, education with a capital E. It's education for the sake of having a coherent society. So,
yeah. Well, I love it. I'm glad I had you explain it, because you did it much better than I was going to say. And I've been exploring Redocracy, and I'm finding it fascinating, just even some of my own patterns that I was like, oh, I already know what it's going to kind of show and output. And it's showing me that, I mean, everybody, you kind of have a good sense about yourself, but yeah, it's showing me some different things too that I'm like, oh, okay, I need to think through some things. And maybe I find myself clicking the same thing. So even just of recent, I was just been thinking about, man, how do I expand my consumption of information in all levels of life to make sure that I'm getting all different angles, so I'm getting a well-rounded opinion, which maybe not everybody knows, but the algorithms work to make sure you get like-minded stuff for that dopamine hit. So, you know, it is opening my eyes. So I have found that really, really fascinating. But before we get into some of these awesome topics that we've got prepped here, I do want to ask, like, what about this concept that you're after with Redocracy and the other work that you're doing? Why are you so passionate about that? I mean, I think as I've continued to learn about your work, you're trying to put like the meat on the bone, so to speak. I know in education, we've talked a lot about competency and skill-based, and how do we show that what the kids learn and they can do it in different ways. Not everything has to be the industrialized model. You know, we know that doesn't work for all, but yet there's some guardrails there. But for you, you're trying to dismantle not just education, but society as we think about learning and processing and how we gather information. Why is that such a core tenet of the work that you do, and why you're so passionate about it?
There's kind of two answers to this. One is more indirectly related to education. The other one is much more directly tied to education. The one broader one is that education, but specifically how education is signaled in society, leads to power. And the inability to proportionally signal competence and somebody who's really well educated, or maybe in unconventional ways, not being able to signal that well, leads to a society where the people that maybe we should have in charge are invisible. And so the motivation there is my family. So my co-founder is my brother. He's our CTO. Yeah, he's a fantastic developer. And we grew up, we're the kids of immigrant parents. Our family came from Romania and Eastern Europe. And growing up, we heard so many incredible stories about grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents who basically the through line was that they were incredible intellectuals, but also very civically minded. So, you know, stories of things they would do that were clearly not in their best self-interest, but were for the collective good. And so we kind of grew up with this idea as the notion of a role model to us, even if it wasn't, you know, it was indirect in some cases, just hearing these stories. But I think having like really internalized that and become passionate about it and thinking that that's, you know, that's what we should look up to and that's how the world maybe should be. First in Romania and Eastern Europe, you know, like the post-communist vacuum and just like the rampant corruption, it became apparent that, you know, people like that weren't the people who were in charge or were winning. But then it became even more evident in North America. So growing up here in Canada, and then, you know, having friends and going to the US, the media ecosystem here, the political ecosystem here was, and as we got older, just more and more optimizing for the polar opposite. So basically the people like my grandparents, great grandparents, those people who, you know, were informed and balanced and helpful and thoughtful and constructive, they were invisible. They were the losers. You'd never hear about them unless you heard these direct stories passed down. And then conversely, the people who are winning in society, who are becoming our politicians and our celebrities and our leaders and role models, were basically the polar opposite. So just like the most divisive, ignorant, aggressive, selfish. And so, you know, one part of the why is this, like, how do we systemically create a way for people like that to be able to acquire power and be recognized instead, because the current system doesn't optimize for that. So that's one part of it. The other why that gets closer to education is, okay, if we get more granular with how people are recognized for what they know and maybe why we should give them a chance and respect them, the way we measure and recognize learning and competence in society right now is so narrow that it leaves so many people behind. I mean, you know, so the stat we like to use to put it in context. So in the US, Americans spend about 13 hours a day with media, you know, and that includes everything from TV and all sorts of stuff. A big part of that is the content. You know, we think about traditionally YouTube, podcasts, articles, newsletters, all this kind of stuff, the conversations around them. Over the course of your life, you'll spend as much time with content as you would studying for about 34 college degrees. Oh, wow. And, you know, even if we dumb that down and say, okay, what if we only calculated based on the amount of time that the average person spends on news online, still about 4 degrees worth of study time in your life for every person. Mm. You know, none of that counts. Even though if you're passionate about something, most of your learning is actually coming through that form. It's not happening when you're in school for a few years of your life. And so when we restrict people to only being able to formally be recognized when they can afford it financially, when they can afford the time in their schedule, when it happens to have aligned with those few years that they chose to do it, and if they change, too bad, that's who you are. And so, you know, if we could make how people are recognized more flexible and transparent and continuous, then what does that mean for 1.2 billion knowledge workers? What does it mean for 700 million high school and higher ed students globally? But then, you know, getting more impact driven, what does it mean for hundreds of millions of immigrants who, it's not just about the money they can afford, but they're probably working multiple jobs and, you know, are trying to acclimatize to a new system and can't make it to class in a structured, scheduled way. And then finally, the people who just don't fit into the system, right? Like, we all know that one person in our lives who is probably the smartest person we know, but they didn't do well in school and they can't do well in school because either it's too boring for them or they don't test well or whatever it may be. And, you know, my brother, our CTO, he's a case study for this, right? Like, he taught himself to code when he was 15. He built one of Canada's first social networks as a teenager. By the time he was done high school, he had this platform with over 200,000 users, doing 40 million hits a month. But he didn't do well in school, and so he couldn't even get into college. Like, his applications were like would not be accepted, weren't being accepted. And so if he didn't have the good fortune of being able to show, you know, because coding allows you to do that, really show yourself, where would he have ended up?
Sure.
Right? So very long-winded answer, but like there's two big whys really in what we do. And one side is this big picture. The other side is just how people get left behind. Like, we're very personally motivated. Even I'm personally autodidactic, right? Like, I studied robotics engineering, but that's absolutely not what I do now. And everything I do today and that I'm good at is completely self-taught. And if we were going by the traditional system, somebody would tell me that I'm supposed to be a failure at what I do because I don't have credentials for it, because I wasn't able to acquire credentials in the traditional way. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's such a fantastic answer. And I think that sets up so perfectly. Thanks for sharing. I mean, some of these topics that we've put together in this random slide deck we'll dive into here. So I think it will strengthen some of your further insights. But even as you're talking, I mean, I was listening selfishly because I'm in this current state of where our legislation is looking at potentially cutting the agencies where I work, and hundreds and thousands of people like myself in education may potentially be out of job. And you start looking for jobs, and I'm like, man, I can do that job, but I don't have a piece of paper with a certain degree. And I did not grow up with, I mean, people who can see the video, I'm a middle-aged white male. Like, I didn't have a lot of setbacks. I'm not going to pretend that I have setbacks, but it's still like a frustrating barrier. I'm like, I have a portfolio of work. I can show you and demonstrate I have the skills to do it, but I don't want to go back to school for another 37 credits for another postgraduate degree to do a job. Like, to me, like I'm really frustrated with that. I mean, I get the system that people have to play in. It's just like, I'm in this crux right now where I'm just like, man, I'm feeling that answer that you just shared here. So it's like, you know, I live a life of privilege. I'm not going to pretend that it isn't there, but I think it's something that so many can relate to as you're talking. Yeah. Like, everybody gets that. Everyone feels that.
You feel it to certain degrees, regardless of where you come from. You know, everybody experiences it. And it's interesting because, you know, I'm not here and I'm be the first person to tell you that there's definitely a future for higher education. And I think anybody who's on top of things understands already how it probably needs to change. This is just about expanding the funnel into it, if anything, and leaving room for it to do what it does well, rather than, you know, sticking to, you know, pre-internet thinking and a 1,000-year-old bureaucracy, doing what it does instead of doing what it should do really well, and leaving the strengths to the modern alternatives that have arisen.
Right. So, no, absolutely. Well, hey, let's segue over. I think we can further unpack this, but I also know that I asked you to put together some topics, and I know that takes time, and I don't want to disregard that either. And I think we'll start to see some through lines here. And so for those that are catching the video part, you will see this screen, and by the time this podcast publishes, this will be nothing new to you. And those listening, we've got four categories of something that sparks Mario and his current learning. What's getting him really hyped up and excited? He's got some really cool topics that I'm really fascinated with. Some things where he shifted his perspective, just some general recommendations, books, TVs, movies, and he's got some ideas in there. I'm not quite sure what they are, so I know I'm intrigued. And then the fourth category is an object. And so the way this goes, in case folks are new to the podcast for the first time, is we will do this randomly. So we put the slides together, but we don't know which one's going to pop up first, and we'll just move through there as if we're just hanging out, chit-chatting over ideas. So we'll start here with the first topic, and then we'll randomize from this point here. But we're going to start with something that brings you some excitement, and we've already maybe started to talk about this a little bit, so we'll let you dive a little deeper. But you put the problems with credentials, verifiability, and status signaling. So talk to me about that.
Yeah, so I think it's really interesting that, like so many things that a lot has been invested in, or that, you know, goes hand in hand with, you know, the modern web, they've kind of become meaningless words or dirty words. So if you tell somebody credentials or micro-credentials, for a lot of people, unfortunately, they're either going to roll their eyes and say, like, okay, this is some fluff, signal you're going to give me that isn't actually attached to anything, and I have no way of evaluating. Or they're going to think of it in this like really archaic traditional way. Like, it's just, there's so much baggage with the term. And there's kind of two things that I've kind of realized and I think are helpful lenses on thinking about the problem, and that I think we've tried to obsess with solving in terms of the credentials Readocracy produces, is exactly this verifiability and status signaling. So what you find, I think, with a lot of credentials, micro-credentials, is that, first of all, unless they come from a school or a company that is already very well respected, you're putting all the signaling on that one brand. So, you know, it works when you get a university degree because people trust the university. But we know that the whole point of micro-credentials and credentials and badges and, you know, this wave that has been going on for a while is like we're trying to separate from that and create like a more fluid and democratized way to recognize things. But if you don't have the signaling component, then you're going to end up with one of the two issues, which is people look at it and say, like, why should I trust you? Or if it's like a provider, like let's say it's Readocracy, and it's like, why should I trust Readocracy? And I think the answer to that is the atomization of signaling. So what you're already seeing with education in general is you're having professors, you're having experts going and using these cohort-based learning platforms and YouTube and different things to go out and teach directly to the people, right? It's kind of like the creator economy side of education. And what that really is, I think it's a fragmentation of that status signaling. So typically you had everything clustered under the one brand, and you're having this fragmentation happening where these different experts and people are going and teaching on their own. And when it comes to learning, what I think is really interesting is if you look at a course reading list, for example, if you were to rethink it and move away from, oh, this is the school I'm going to, and they're the ones who are going to certify me, I'm going to trust their brand. If you look at the reading list itself, and the experts in that list who produced the material, who endorsed it, any commentary on it from other places, where do they work? Where do they teach? If you were to make it so that credentials would actually lean into the who the people are who are actually defining the content that you're consuming and where they work and where they study, anything else you can signal around that and make that explicitly part of credentials, I think it would solve a lot of the issues that exist where we place all the weight, all our eggs in one basket of the brand of an institution rather than fragmenting and spreading out across all the institutions that are represented by the learning you're experiencing. So that's one thing. So like the status signaling piece, I think, is not thought about enough. And we end up with so many badges, which whether it's on LinkedIn or somewhere else, where it's like somebody looks at it and says, you know, why should I care about this? Who cares? Like, this is not appealing to me. Whereas, you know, for example, if just made an example, let's say I was making a credential on Readocracy through design thinking. And typically, if you were trying to get a design thinking certificate, it'd be from some institution or from some school. But like in this way of thinking, you go in and say, hey, there's this design thinking certificate. And the first thing you see when you're looking at it is like this learning came through so-and-so design thinking leader at Netflix, so-and-so design thinking leader at IDEO, so-and-so design thinking leader at Nike. And this is the signaling I'm seeing, which for a lot of people, as long as the rest is also legit, that in some ways is even more powerful. And it's not about Readocracy or whatever provider is. It kind of has that. So that's one side. On the verifiability, and this is kind of more straightforward, and it kind of goes hand in hand with it a bit, we have these credentials that exist. And I mean, degrees and diplomas, certificates are just as guilty as this is as any other modern badge. You can't check the learning. Like, again, you're just completely counting on the institution or the brand saying, trust us, real learning happened here. You can't check it unless you go and interview them, but just trust us, all this stuff happened. And obviously now this is, you know, people are trying to change this with LERs and all sorts of stuff. But, you know, I think credentials will live up to their potential and we can, you know, separate ourselves from our, by necessity marriage to the, you know, these big behemoth institutions and how things are done when we will be able to have credentials that have completely transparent transcripts completely built in already. So if I, you know, in a perfect future, when I pull up a degree or a diploma or a badge, I should be able to see all the learning that happened. happened, what they consumed, the discussion contributions they made, their annotations, their exam results. Like, I should be able to pull that up immediately and see for myself instead of just looking at a piece of paper or a 2D badge on my computer.
Yeah. No, I love it. I mean, I'm thinking about the amount of badges, and I have chased down many, good and bad. And there are some where I earn badges. I don't know that I did a single thing, but I have a badge that says I did something. And then I've got other badges where, like, man, I could actually showcase a portfolio of work or a portfolio of thought or, proof to that. And I think that's, to me, as I'm looking in that space and in education, we're trying to figure that out too a little bit. Like, how can we demonstrate the learning, the standard, the skill set, the competency versus, like, can you pass this test? Like, where the skills along the way? And, you know, we've still got a long way to go there. But, man, it's so spot on with what you're talking about. And I'm just thinking through, like, because I think there's such a saturation of not very good courses, ways to earn badges, I think they all take a hit, unfortunately. Yep. Even the good ones. Yep. I don't think anyone is jumping for joy if on the resume you've got, hey, I've got these, 40 badges. Maybe it's nice, maybe it's not nice, but I think most of it is just like, okay, like let's get to the next phase, and I think it's kind of this, I see it as like a saturation, and I'm like stuck, like, do I keep chasing these? Is it a waste of time? But, like, I don't know, it's an interesting place to be. But the idea is what I believe in the idea. Like, it's when I talk about project-based learning and authentic learning, like, that's what I'm after. And I'm like, this actually is not the way it currently exists, the way to go about putting proof to the pudding, so to speak.
Yeah, it's again coming back to this idea that in some ways it's in parallel to when the modern web came about, we said, oh, it's going to revolutionize education, and it did in the sense that it made it possible to have democratized access to educational materials. But what we didn't take into account is, unless you can prove people's relationship with those educational materials, it doesn't formally matter. And so you're not lifting people up, you're not changing economic mobility just by giving them these materials, because it doesn't count. And I think it comes back similarly, like, of course, badges and micro-credentials, alternative credentials are very important. And I'm not dismissing the fact that they need to exist. It's more, how do we make sure that these things live up to the promise, right? How do we make sure that we don't have dragging everybody down because we're putting so much, noise out instead of defensible substance?
Yeah, no, I love it. Yeah, it's so good. It's such great stuff to think about. Whether we're the ones issuing badges or not doing any of that work, thinking about, I think at the end of the day, what is quality work? And are we providing that for others? And are we providing that for ourselves? I think that's a great question. So let's shift to another one here. This one, I hit the little randomizer button there for those that can't see. And this is ask for a topic on reflecting on a recent shift in your perspective, which has proved to be pretty interesting categories. People have talked. I've seen some pretty cool ideas. And you've got, this is one, I'm really glad this came up, because I'm fascinated through this prompt here. You put democracy through Socrates' eyes.
Yeah.
So what are we thinking here, man?
So I, given the theme here, and I know, like, make it feel like we're, having coffee or whatever, I threw some wild cards in here, which I think
I love it.
Just interesting. So, the name redocracy, like our company and our vision comes from, it's a portmanteau of reading and meritocracy, supporting democracy. And, there's different ways of governing. And one of them is epistocracy, which is, governing through those who are smart or qualified. And there's, it's dangerous, because then, of course, that's abused. And whoever decides who's smart becomes a person in power. And what is the definition of smart? All these things. But I think I've thought a lot about, how do you overcome that? How do you, make it so that when people vote, when they exercise their power, there's some accountability, and you don't take it for granted. You don't distort the society that comes to be through your ignorance or through your manipulation. And Socrates didn't like democracy, because he felt that it was foolish to just arbitrarily assign power to everybody equally. And one of the examples is like, if you're about to embark on a voyage across rough seas, and you are picking a crew and figuring out who's going to lead the crew and who's going to decide how to make sure we don't all drown, are you just going to go in and say, hey, everybody, you have equal rights, we're going to do this together, we're going to figure it out? Or do you actually, you know, look at who's actually qualified based on their experience, and we take their strategy to decide who to move forward, and maybe everybody else votes on that? So it's just, you can look more through kind of Socrates' view on this, but it's the gist is that. But I've been thinking a lot about that, and I think we were kind of already looking at it through the philosophy when I kind of caught up and reread on Socrates' take on it. It kind of shifted my perspective and maybe taking something that I was kind of on the fence on and pushing me even further and thinking like, yeah, this is something we need to look at more carefully, ensuring it doesn't take away people's agency and everybody truly has the opportunity to participate equally as long as they're willing to put in the work and not be lazy, no matter their intelligence level, no matter their literacy level, no matter what it is. But yeah, it kind of made me reapproach this idea.
Yeah, I'm actually really glad this popped up because I was waiting and hoping that it would pop up. Because I created a custom GPT of Socrates that I use as like a thought debate partner in my work. And I've been showing some use cases with that, how it can be used with students and whatever. When I saw this, I was like, man, I really want to pose the question. But I refrained until I at least got to hear your ideas first. And now I'm further excited to go jump into it and see what the AI version of Socrates is. Gotta chime my way here. So it's definitely, I think it speaks, you know, kind of going back to the work that you're doing, right? Like, how do we continue to bring in different perspectives and thoughts and angles of how we perceive concepts, the world, people, all the different types of thoughts? I mean, I think this Democracy Through Socrates' Eyes is a perfect example of this is the kind of thinking we should be doing, you know? And doesn't mean that just because I explore it means I have to like saturate myself in it, but I at least should be aware of what are, you know, this is how we grow as a society. And I think it's how we get better. And we get so funneled into like one lane of thought that we get to a point. I think we see it now where nobody wants to listen anymore. No one wants to actually hear another thought.
Yes. Yes. And not just that, but also I think it's more important than ever to consider ideas like this, because I think too many people are still thinking that our information's commons is neutral. And maybe the people will say, oh, you know, the social platforms are censoring my questionable speech or whatever it may be. But what we forget is that we're not in a neutral environment. The attention economy and surveillance capitalism dictates that the more divisive and provocative you are, the better you'll perform. So the reality is that if we're in an environment where we're running elections, and the future of your country or your city or whatever it may be is based on how everybody was able to inform themselves, and we are actually in an environment that it was adversarial to us being well-informed, because the reality is, for example, we've seen this in journalism. Journalism is currently a race to the bottom. Good luck trying to survive if you're committed to doing in-depth research and investing in that, because that's just not how you're going to make money. But if you can go and just do high-volume clickbait, you'll have better odds at sticking around. And if that's the environment in which we're informing ourselves and therefore dictating our leaders and therefore dictating how our lives are going to be, should we not be more careful about assigning some sort of foundational proof of work or proof of effort or proof of neutrality before we find out that in fact what we voted on together was mass manipulation, for example? And again, coming from a position that we're in a situation where the medium is adversarial to us getting the ideal outcome for what's healthy for us.
Yeah, I love that. I was just as you were talking, I was trying to pull up. I was just listening to Tim Ferriss, one of his recent podcasts. I'll put a link in the show notes. I won't waste time here.
Yeah,
no, but it was essentially this guy's a columnist, and he does write for the New Yorker. And Tim Ferriss was very much going off. I would say attacking him. Tim Ferriss doesn't do that, but talking about like it's one of the few remaining pieces that really dives into like long form writing, and at the same time we're starting to see even like the New Yorker, and I don't read the New Yorker, but I've I'm aware of it. Also, then does still have clickbait ads because they still got to like attract people. And so they are like in this, like what they're known for is this very in-depth, you know, I always kind of feel like slow reads, right? Like it's very thorough. Yeah. It's a 20 page thing about a person that did a thing that you wouldn't normally think about, but like that's the beauty of it. Like it is. Yeah. And, but that doesn't sell anymore. And so it was.
Yeah, and I love the New Yorker, actually. It's one of my favorite publications because it leans so heavily into like in-depth curiosity, but and like unconventional takes or perspectives. But it's interesting because even there, like you think of the term clickbait, this is why language is so important. And I mean, one of my goals for this year is to release, maybe in book form, a glossary for the age of information overload with like all sorts of terminology that exists, but is maybe not mainstream and people therefore can't have the conversations around these subjects. But like clickbait, for example, there's so many things that are ugly terms, but then we demonize all sorts of other things as these terms are weaponized. So clickbait, when it's, sure, it's a New Yorker putting out a article or a title or investing in it in the first place because it's so quirky and unconventional and like you just want to go in and see what it's all about, is very different from clickbait, which is outright dishonest or offensive or, you know, right? So like there's this spectrum that we have to look at just the same way advertising. Not all advertising is evil. Not all, you know, recommendations are evil. And I think there are these nuances that we have to consider. And maybe it does start with, you know, in the first place, having the nuance in what we're paying attention to, but also even the language to talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, I want to make sure we get to some of these other topics, one of my recent unveilings, I'll put a link in one of the previous podcasts was with Chief Privacy Security Officer, and we got into this topic of information, disinformation, and misinformation. And while we were talking to him, I'm like, God, that makes sense. But like, I didn't really like process like the different categories of information. You know, it's almost in my brain. It's kind of this old school black and white. It's true or false, which I know better. I mean, propaganda and a former history teacher, I know that. But then but since that recording, I came across another word called malformation, which I learned on another podcast, which maybe does have some malformation. So I won't disclose that one. But I was like, there's so many different things. We're like, they're actually using facts, but not the way the facts should be intended to use. And I'm I was just like, gosh, this is. I think about my children. I have one in college, a high school, and a junior high child, and I'm like, their social media is probably saturated in malformation, right? The quick thing, here's some facts, but then I'm going to spin it a little way. And I don't mean all for evil. Not everything is evil, but in order to like get them thinking, so they come back and keep consuming whatever the consumption might be. So it's anyways, it's just a. I just keep peeling back layers. And I'm like, oh, there's so much. which goes through, I mean, the work that you're after, right? Like, how do we create this space with quality, vetted, verified work that shows what we've actually been doing and not falling prey to not just bad things, but also make sure that we're also getting exposed to the quality information that we all deserve, you know?
So, exactly. That we deserve.
Yes.
Can't agree more.
All right, so let's get into another topic of something that sparks incitement in you. And we've got here, we need a new infrastructure for society. And you've got subtitle starts with rethinking how we value learning when education only matters for work and school. We ensure it doesn't matter the rest of the time.
Yes. So, this is maybe the biggest one. I think when we think of infrastructure in society, we're so used to thinking of it in forms of physical things. So, you know, our pipes and our factories and our satellites and our transit. But there's also the infrastructure of behavior and the infrastructure of thought. And in the past, you could argue that this is the function of education. So education was creating a baseline where everybody would be helpfully conditioned to think constructively and in a well-structured and informed way. However, we've seeded this ground. Whether we know it or not, we've seeded this ground to a new infrastructure, and that is the information infrastructure, but specifically the attention economy and the attention infrastructure. So when we think of how people behave in society today, and then how it maps to power, coming back to kind of what I said at the top of the show, there really is only one system which so deeply and broadly has penetrated everything and we can all easily identify. So if you ask any 10-year-old, what does it mean to be popular? They are almost certainly going to talk to you about likes and views and getting attention and maybe knowing how to dance for TikTok. Like, it's the spectacle. There is no reason anyone would tell you, like, oh, actually, oh, you asked me about popularity. I think it's really about how smart you are and, like, how informed you are. Like, there's no reason they would bring that up. Like, they would have to be a really cerebral child to even think of that. And they probably wouldn't, it's not even the right answer, actually, in terms of how the system actually works. It's actually detrimental to you, in fact. Or like, again, I'm just giving these examples to show how broad and mainstream.
Yeah, yeah.
So you find like a stay-at-home mom in the middle of nowhere who has an online business. Again, you just ask her, like, what does it mean to be popular? And again, she's going to give you very similar answers. These are things that we all understand. You ask a politician, how are you going to win? They are going to tell you about the amount of attention and spectacle they can attract, right? We're seeing it all around us. And so you really, you know, we've taken this for granted and kind of said like, oh, this is the way the world works, but it doesn't need to be this way. And so what we need is for this infrastructure to not be running unopposed. Today, when people invest in fixing things, what they're really doing is putting Band-Aids on this infrastructure and trying to change it with a bit of duct tape here and there. You're not going to do that. It is what it is. And what we really need is to think thoughtfully about, and also pragmatically more than anything, how we can have an alternative infrastructure. That's really what we're trying to do with Redocracy, big picture, is how do you make it so that instead of people structurally and measurably and economically only being able to focus on the amount of attention they get and the quantity of attention they get, how can you have an alternative infrastructure plugged into society just as widely, just as pervasively, that is about the quality of attention you give? How do we co-opt the mechanisms that make us obsessed with ego and status and visibility and financial opportunity and map them using largely the same data onto how informed you are? What is your reputation? What is your track record? Why do you deserve to have the visibility and the podium you are getting? And right now you can't do that. You cannot do that. You can't go into Twitter X. You can't go into Facebook, Instagram, and build the algorithm to take into account somebody's track record or the sources they've been sharing or the thoughtfulness of their comments, these things. That's not part of it. It's just volume. And so what this idea is that I'm really excited about is we actually have the means. We have the data. It's possible. We just haven't done it. And I think a lot of it is that we've just, you know, we're kind of Stockholm syndrome babies of the attention economy. And, you know, and it matters because in an education context as well, we're so used to saying, oh, you know, you should really care about your education because it's going to be about how you're going to get a job. And therefore, it's going to be like how you make a living. And so in the end, we formally care about education, how we inform ourselves when we're going to graduate, when we apply to a job, when we're being evaluated. But then the rest of the time, your education and how informed you are and how you learn is not actually formally valuable. You don't have a way of plugging that in. Can you imagine if every degree that existed from every college and every high school diploma and every class you take actually was something that you could take and just plug in when you went on Facebook and when you went on social media to actually affect it? This would be, you know, huge.
So, like, I can't imagine anybody listening arguing or any of the ideas that you have been sharing today. But I am curious, like, what, like, resistance are you receiving as you're trying to bring these ideas out? Because the people that are the gatekeepers got to that point through positions of power and most likely because the algorithms favor their work or whoever got them into places. And I'm not saying they're all bad. I don't want to just come across like they're all evil people, because that's not the case. But like, I am curious, like, how do you start to trigger some of the levers to bring these ideas, you know, I mean, I think that's obviously what you're trying to do with Readocracy, mm-hmm. I think to a certain degree, but like, what is some of that pushback that you're getting as you're having conversations, you're bringing this out? Because I'm just, again, thinking like the listeners going, yeah, well, yeah, this just makes sense. Yeah. Why is it not happening? And there are reasons it doesn't happen. So I'm just fascinated from your world, your lens, like what's happening here? How do people say no?
Yeah.
And maybe they're not saying no, but I mean, I'm just assuming like it's not widespread yet.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, I mean, this is such a good question because there's so many pieces to it. On one side, the fact that there aren't other startups who are doing this or companies is because it's not easy and it takes time. And you know, this is a whole other conversation we could have, but the definition of innovation these days is this culture of fail fast and pivot quickly and, you know, exit quick. And that's the mainstream. And unfortunately, it's actually being compounded, the younger generations. Like, it's really like, oh, if I haven't made it in X time, like, I'm out of here. And we don't have infrastructure in place for people to think deeply about problems and get to these nuances that you would need. There's no way I could tell you any of these things or have even a vague solution around this without investing years in this, like years and years, and thinking through it. And, you know, it's kind of like if you're facing a brick wall, the norm is like, throw yourself at the brick wall a few times. It's not working. You haven't smashed through. Okay, go do something else. Find another brick wall and one that like shatters easily, or you can find a way around it. But with big problems like this, that's not enough. You have to throw yourself at this thing so many times and so intensely and so creatively until you shatter apart at the atomic level and start finding cracks. And next thing you know, you discover the different lens or find yourself on the other side. So that's like part of it, like why it's maybe not more common, because this is like super ambitious, and thinking of it from a structural perspective, a behavioral psychology perspective is like not fun. It's not fun. It's not quick. So that's part of it. The other side is what we're used to thinking of. So the digital advertising and data market is huge. It's $500 billion. But typically, like when people think of like, oh, you know, why wouldn't you use attention for anything else? Like, this is where the money's at. But this is more like a paradigm shift thing. Like, once you reframe it and say, okay, yeah, $500 billion, a lot of money. People are spending over $1 trillion a year on degrees, certificates, memberships, trying to prove themselves. If you look at the S&P 500 and what the value is that drives these companies, it's not, you know, their real estate. It's not, you know, the tangible things they own. It's all the intangibles. Like 84% of the value is intellectual property and reputation. It's $21 trillion. And so like these different ways you can frame it, say like, okay, if you could take attention and map it in this different way, there's actually so much market to be explored that is even more valuable, but nobody's looking in that direction. It's kind of blue ocean. Nobody's thinking in that way. They just think there's no money to be made. And so that's part of it. Then lastly, like, sure, we're not going to convince Facebook or these people to change their ways. We're not. They'd mess up their business model, actually, in terms of like low quality and high volume. But it comes back to behavioral psychology. It's not about getting the platforms to shift. It's about the grassroots and behavioral psychology piece where people can't resist it at an individual and community level. And so if you think, let me put it this way. These are literally things that will be live later this year with Readocracy. If you go on a subreddit or you go on a Discord server and you're looking through, you're scrolling through, and you see that some of the users, every time they post, there's a thing injected right under them pointing out that this person is informed and giving you a link and saying you should trust this person and click through to see all the stuff they know, or adding other elements to the interface that make them literally more visual even without those added injected context comments that are happening every time. And it's only happening for these users. They stand out in the stream. You're like, I have to look at this person. Who the hell else is the other person? By contradiction, are all these other people ignorant? And so next thing you know, you're like, oh, it's a first mover advantage. My power and popularity is dictated by my ability to prove I am informed, because now the server or the subreddit is using the Readocracy integration and has the bot injecting this context. And so at that point, it's behavioral psychology. It's not about me caring about society being more informed. It's people saying like, oh man, like, I don't want to fall behind. So that's how you get people to shift. And the same behavioral psychology that applies on an individual level applies at an institutional level as well. I mean, you talk about schools. How do we get a school to be interested in this? Well, they might see us as a threat if they're really old school, or they should see us as an opportunity to make new money. So if I come in and say, hey, realistically, the data shows that Gen Z and especially Alpha are increasingly doubting whether it's worth the money. And you can't sustainably operate if you start charging way less. Wouldn't it be nice if you could create a whole slew of micro-credentials that are self-generating, self-grading, don't require the overhead, and therefore allow you to offer a lower price point, which actually is infinitely scalable and could eventually outpace your main one? Don't you want to prepare for the future and have something defensible and revenue generating? Like, this is all behavioral psychology and applies just as much to media. Like, there's, you know, to stop on this rant I'm on here, but like, there's like the four pillars of media and society. There's you know, information is used in corporations, it's used in education, it's used in media, and it's used in the platforms. That's one way you could think of it. And sure, we might not get the platforms to go and shift all the behavior around this, but all the other three got screwed by the platforms. And now they have an opportunity to defend themselves, find new revenue channels, new power opportunities. And so this is how change happens. And the last thing I just want to say on this, because I think it's important and it might be on some listeners' minds. If you come back to the idea of a new infrastructure for society, one of the main things you should be asking is, who decides what is quality? Who decides what is truth? And, you know, people who get a chance to think this through will say like, oh, that's, yeah, that could be dangerous if Readocracy, for example, or whoever else would try to do this, is arbitrarily just saying, oh, this person's trustworthy, this person's not, because they spent time on this information, we're just going to give them this label. The key thing with this infrastructure is transparency, verifiability, and as much as possible, removing the human from the loop. And so that's, you know, I think with this, when you talk about infrastructure society, it's very important that, let's say if you're in a feed that's reorganized in this way, you can click through and see the sources. Then you can see the methodology for those sources. You can see the data on everything. And anything that is labeled is not because we say so, it's because the data tells you. So, you know, yeah.
Man, this is why I love having guests like you on the show, because there's just so much to think about in lots of good ways. I mean, it's just, you're again, just, I appreciate you taking time to share those insights, because it's getting me thinking in some ways that I don't think I've thought of before. And, you know, that's definitely how we get better in terms of trying to figure out just how to be good humans. I think at the end of the day, I think that's what everybody's after. And I know that's not the case for every single person on earth, but you know, like, just how do we become better people? And you've really given some great thoughts there. And even as you were talking about that fail fast, I've slowly shifted some of my thoughts around that too. And I think back to, I jumped on that, and as I try to do some project-based design work in class, I was like, hey, look, we just got to go. We got to go. We got to make it. Just keep iterating. And I've been slowly kind of changing that. And as you were talking, it finally came back to me of who the guest was on the Tim Ferriss show, because he talked about this very thing that you're trying to do. It was Cal Newport. He is the one that also writes for The New Yorker.
Cal Newport, yeah.
And he's got a book coming out called Slow Productivity. And it's actually like, you take time, like, you're not just like trying to stick everything against the wall to see what sticks. It's you have an idea, and then you really, really investigate it. And it kind of is, I shouldn't say kind of, it goes against a lot of the societal things that we've all become accustomed to, that we think we need to just go a million miles an hour and, you know, and find out really quick what works or what doesn't. And he has a different, he's always been a little bit different methodical approach. You know, you can't find him on the socials. But yet people know his work. And that's just so, I don't think the book's out yet, but it definitely aligns with a lot of what you were just sharing there.
Deep work.
So, Mario. I want to be respectful of your time here, but I also so twofold: respectful of time and also respect to the topic.
The audience.
We could probably talk for like 4 hours, which would be great.
Yeah.
But are there any other topics that, I mean, we don't have time for them all, but the listeners, you'll be able to chance to check them all out. And then if you have conversations, you can reach out to Mario and explore more. But are there any other ones that you want to make sure you get a chance to highlight while we still have a little bit of time here? I want to make sure I won't hit the randomizer, but I know there's lots of good ones in there, or maybe just some other idea that kind of manifested through this conversation. You're like, man, I really want to make sure I speak to that.
I think we touched on really good ones. I think maybe the last one I would have wanted to talk about and make sure we talk about is in the context of AI, which is obviously in everybody's mind. Just a few key ideas, very briefly. One is we already got ripped off by the big tech platforms once already, where they got rich off our data and we got, if anything, the dregs of it, and then, targeted back with our own data while they became trillion-dollar companies. And I think the same thing is happening again with our intellectual data. And I think part of the importance of Readocracy or us really rethinking the value of education, but also the digital exhaust of our education, our learning, whether it happens in a formal environment or informal environment, is that this is tangible economic value now. And I would really encourage people to think about that, because when you think there's a shadow war already happening, billions of dollars are being spent on acquiring knowledge graphs, acquiring curated expert perspectives, because this is the core to training these models. When people think about AI and they get all caught up in the hype, I think we need to take a step back and actually think of this perspective, where the learning you're doing every day and how schools are havens for learning, they are therefore havens of knowledge data. And there's a lot of economic value to be had. And if we're ignorant about it, just the same way we're with our interests data, which social media hoovered up, we're missing the boat. So that's one thing. And then hand in hand with that is the need for what I would call proof of human knowledge. So, we were so obsessed with the output and doing everything based on output. So your exam went well, okay, you passed, the final test. But when everything can be fabricated so easily, I think it becomes more important than ever to more deeply measure and evaluate the process and the input. And I think this will matter just as much in an educational context as it will in society, where, the scary thing isn't everything around you becoming bots. The scary thing is about everybody around you being a real person who gets the verified checkmark because they passed the test because they're a human being. And they're actually just a parrot for ChatGPT that they have up on a second screen, especially when everybody's working remote. You have no idea you're getting. And so, I think this concept of proof of human knowledge is super, super important, and being able to, deeply assess and have that data for what's going in. So, those are just kind of it. And, we can include it maybe in the show notes of the recommendations, but I know it was one of the prompts, but if there's one book I recommend, it's Amusing Ourselves to Death. And specifically the foreword, which is one of the best forewords you've ever read from a book in terms of concisely blowing your mind. So,
did you want to read it real quick as we
bring
the show to a close?
Yeah,
let's do it. Let's hammer it out, because all the listeners know we'll get links to anything we talked about, as well as some of the other slides that we didn't get to. We'll get all that stuff referenced in here. But I know you wanted to read this forward, and I think it's gonna be perfect.
It's only one page, so bear with me here. So this book came out in 1985, I believe. It's one of those books that just, if you don't know it, it somehow gets more true with time, because he actually wrote this about television, and then it just became more true with the internet. The foreword goes like this.
So, hey, friend. So, unfortunately, we had a couple glitches with our internet connection. And so, as Mario went to read the foreword and let's discuss it, we lost the signal in there. And so without having to reschedule and try to find more time for him to finish up the last few bits, I've decided to go ahead and just play the video and the foreword as I put it into a ChatGPT plus a AI video tool in one of the GPT tools. So if you're watching the video, you will see the AI-generated video that goes with the foreword for Neil Postman's book. And if you're listening, you get to hear an AI-generated voice read the foreword. And while we do miss out on the really important closer of talking about the book, this is how we will wrap up this particular podcast. And so I hope that you check out the show notes. I hope you check out all the work that he talked about. Go check out Readocracy. It is really, really fascinating. It is something that I've been using to vet and utilize my sources, what I'm reading, what I'm spending time on, organizing my thoughts and notes. And as always, if you've enjoyed this conversation, connect with him, connect with me, leave some comments, let us know what you're thinking, what questions you have. And as always, my friends, remember, stay awesome. Peace.
We were keeping our eye on 1984. When the year came and the prophecy didn't, thoughtful Americans sang softly in praise of themselves. The roots of liberal democracy had held. Wherever else the terror had happened, we at least had not been visited by Orwellian nightmares. But we had forgotten that alongside Orwell's dark vision, there was another, slightly older, slightly less well-known, equally chilling, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Contrary to common belief even among the educated, Huxley and Orwell did not prophesy the same thing. Orwell warns that we will be overcome by an externally imposed oppression. But in Huxley's vision, no Big Brother is required to deprive people of their autonomy, maturity, and history. As he saw it, people will come to love their oppression, to adore the technologies that undo their capacities to think. What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much that we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared we would become a trivial culture, preoccupied with some equivalent of the feelies, the orgy porgy, and the centrifugal bumble puppy. As Huxley remarked in Brave New World Revisited, the civil libertarians and rationalists who are ever on the alert to oppose tyranny failed to take into account man's almost infinite appetite for distractions. In 1984, Huxley added, "People are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure." In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us. This book is about the possibility that Huxley, not Orwell, was right.
Chaos. Woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning, chilling with Coffee Wugs, me and Coffee Chugs, talking education all across the nation, pushing boundaries, thinking innovation. Chaos.